HPPodcast.com.
So you have the reflux. And what will you do with that, little man?
That was a line delivered by Mr. Chris Sarandon from the film The Resurrected. It wasn't an advertisement for Pepsid AC or some other antacid. That was a line from the movie. And it used to be my favorite line from this movie. Yeah. But in this last viewing, I found one from earlier in that scene, same scene, that I like even better. It's this line. As strong as my hunger for knowledge may be, my hunger for food is so much stronger. That is one of the dumbest lines I've ever heard.
Oh,
and I want another t-shirt.
Wow.
That's the I drink and know things of this movie. Everything about it's funny. I think that's true. Everybody, right? No matter how hungry you are for knowledge, your hunger for food is going to be stronger if you're alive.
It's definitely going to be stronger. Yeah, well.
Man. However, it is a line from a movie I genuinely, genuinely love.
I love it too. I love The Resurrected. And we're going to talk about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. It's our bonus show exclusively on Patreon. Let's dig in.
The Resurrected is a 1991 horror film based on the case of Charles X. DeWard by H.P. Lovecraft. It was directed by Dan O'Bannon and stars John Terry, Jane Sibbett, and friend of the show, Chris Sarandon.
Yes.
It only saw a limited theatrical release, went straight to video in 1992.
Which was around the time that I watched it.
Yeah, me too.
I think the video I watched it on was already a dub. Maybe I got it from you? I don't remember.
I went to school in Pittsburgh, so I had a bunch of horror movie buffs, and there was bootleg copies of things I got handed around quite a bit, and I think I might have got an early bootleg even before it was released on regular video.
Gotcha. That must have been how I got it. Yeah, but I think the video release even had a pretty bad print on it.
Yeah,
as well. The movie never was released in a way that looked good. So I picked up the Blu-ray prior to doing this show, and I watched it again, and I was so glad it looked so much better than any time I've ever seen it prior to this, which has only been on video. I mean, I don't know the last time I watched it. Years ago.
Yeah.
Whenever I owned a VCR, which who knows how long ago that was, 15 years ago or something. So, sound design, on the other hand, really could have used some help.
Well, yeah, that is true. Now, the writer was Brent V. Friedman. He worked on the script on his own, and the movie was called Shatterbrain. So, he was adapting Charles Dexter Ward, a project of his that he was doing. He got some producers involved. Those producers got O'Bannon in to be the director.
And Dan O'Bannon, obviously, we've spoken about before.
Yeah.
Most recently when we did that episode on Alien. He's a very big dude in genre entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And watching the interview with the writer on the Blu-ray, I had really hoped he would explain that title, Shatterbrain, because I kind of don't get it. I always thought that this was called The Resurrected, and then they tried to change the title to make it more accessible to, on the video shelf or something like that to kind of make it a little more exciting for horror fans, and so they switched to Shatterbrain, but apparently that's the original title.
Mm-hmm.
What does that even mean? Why would you call it that? I don't understand it.
I don't get it either.
Brent Friedman's gone on to write a bunch of other stuff. He wrote episodes of Twilight Zone and Star Wars Rebels, Star Trek Enterprise. He's a good writer. He had been a big Lovecraft fan in his 20s, and he read this book, and in his words, naively decided to adapt it. Because I guess that's the only way to go after doing a Lovecraft adaptation for film, is naively.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about the story and how hard it is to crack while I was watching it this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that I didn't watch it, obviously, when I was a teenager, first came across it.
Mm-hmm.
We've been, particularly with respect to The Invisible Man and recent work we've been doing, I've been thinking again about Wells' Law, which was the idea that you can have one bit of magic in a story, and then the rest of the story needs to be really anchored in reality.
Sure.
And explore that weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have more fantastic things happening, then it's silly. And this movie violates that law like a violent predator, I think. And okay. I don't actually, it's not an issue with the movie, it's an issue with the book.
Sure.
If you're going to do a faithful adaptation of it, you're going to have all the same issues that are issues in the book. But these things I never thought about, as I said, when I watched it when I was a teenager. I liked a lot of plot back then, so it was all fine with me. But now I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, first of all, there's a formula that can return people from the dead if you have their complete remains.
Right.
That should really be it. There's a lot to explore there, particularly with respect to the things, like if you have incomplete remains, it creates these effed up monsters,
right,
which are awesome, and that's something to be scared of. And then it leads right into a 1700s dude trying to make it in the 1980s, which is also great.
Yeah.
That all comes from that one central idea, and I think it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
But Then, also, we are to believe that Charles Dexter Ward and Joseph Kerwin are as alike as twins. That's a second weird thing.
Yes.
You know?
Okay.
And I think that's totally not only incredible, but it's kind of impossible.
Sure.
I mean, it's depicted in horror films a lot. It's not like this is the first movie to do it. Like, in the other Chris Sarandon vehicle, Fright Night, he has a painting of Amy, and there she is reincarnated as this teenager. They did it in Coppola's Dracula. It comes up a lot, where somebody is exactly like somebody from long ago. But here, the resemblance is so strong that his wife is tricked. It's too much.
Maybe too much for you.
It wasn't. It was just on this viewing, I was a little more critical of story. And then you have whatever it is that happens in the climax with the flesh of the two people melding together. We could get into that later.
Sure.
That's weird, too. But honestly, as I was thinking about it, if I were to do this, and I'm sure it would make Lovecraft purists angry, but I would just cut the resemblance angle. I don't think you need it.
But part of the twist of it is that they swap places. I mean, that's a big part of it.
But could you do it in a way where the ancestor commits some kind of identity theft, but isn't literally looks exactly like it? I don't know. We can talk about it as we keep going. I have to apologize, by the way, if I'm a little hard on this movie right now, because I just had a test screening for my own movie last night. And it's one of those things where you invite a bunch of people to come watch and critique it and give you notes, and then you feel like, why is everybody being so critical? You know, it's totally, I don't know why, it's so psychologically dumb, but it's painful to get those notes, and then you start second-guessing yourself.
Right.
So all of that energy I got from last night, I'm going to take out on this. So remember, I do love the movie.
I get what you're saying, and you're right. Yeah. You're right, but for me being the nerd that I am, I like these complex things, and I like to dig into them, and I like having them this way. Do I think it's an accessible movie to most people? No way.
Right.
Dan O'Bannon was actually working on an adaptation of Charles Dexter Ward on his own, but could never quite get it right. And when he found Friedman's script, that script had worked out some of the problems that he was having structurally with it.
Right, because I think he had been working on it for like 10 years or something.
Yeah, yeah. And the other title for this movie that they were going to use was The Ancestor, but when it came out, they went with the title The Resurrected instead.
Right.
This was O'Bannon's first movie since Return of the Living Dead 7 years prior.
Now that is a perfect movie.
My God.
No issues with that one.
That movie's so good. I watched a lot of the extras, and it seems that Dan O'Bannon was very ill during production. He had Crohn's disease. It was a problem throughout his life. And it was rumored that he didn't finish the movie. Who did? There doesn't seem to be enough information out there about actually who was doing the direction.
Yeah, it seems like there were some serious conflicts between he and the producers. Folks in the extras, they only hint at or mention obliquely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the composer Richard Band, he didn't even meet O'Bannon while he was working on this movie.
Wow.
And the writer had made some kind of comment as to maybe O'Bannon wasn't even there all the time while they were shooting. So I don't really know what happened. It might have been some budgetary stuff. I'm not sure. It could have been just that he was ill, but
yeah.
I think there was some kind of conflict going on. I don't know how happy Dan O'Bannon was with the finished product. But the score, Dan O'Bannon did say he liked. He eventually met the composer a few years later. I have to say, I really love the score for this movie.
Yeah,
I think it really elevates it from typical low-budget fare from the period.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great. Richard Band had also done Reanimator and From Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
This was right in his wheelhouse. But I think this score is excellent.
I think it's his best, yeah.
Yeah.
The movie is a modern retelling of the case of Charles Dexter Ward, as I said before, with some things twisted around to make it work as a film, all of which I loved.
Yeah. And like I say, I loved it unquestioningly in 1992. I did sense that there were issues with the movie, and I definitely knew the performance. The performances aren't always great in this movie.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, you have to admit that at the time.
Nope. I do not.
I will say, at that time, it definitely was the best Lovecraft adaptation I'd ever seen, and I think it still is way up there.
Yeah.
I mean, a direct adaptation, not a Lovecraftian movie, but an actual adaptation of one of his
pieces.
I mean, it's faithful, and in the scary moments, it really delivers, and it definitely captures the flavor of Lovecraft's world and his stuff, despite any problems that it may have.
But it definitely
does. Let's go through it a little linearly here. So what I love is this movie's scary right out of the gate because they show the MGM logo. And that lion roars at the camera. And that scared the shit out of me when I turned this on. Generally, I gotta be honest, generally I never make it past that part of any MGM movie. But I knew we had to do this for bonus content, so I just clenched my teeth, wore my diaper, I got through.
Wow, okay,
but that opening with the lion is, oh my God.
Yeah. So the movie begins with the aftermath of something crazy that happened in an asylum. And Charles Dexter Ward has escaped.
I love the janitor who says, I'm not going in there. I'm not going into that room. It gives you that Lovecraftian flavor right away.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that room, there's a crazy burned black mark on the floor, blood everywhere. I mean, everywhere.
Yeah.
And this decapitated body, the head on the other side of the room. It's a really strong opening.
It is.
Grabs you right away. Yeah.
And we see a messed up bleeding guy in his office, and he's talking into a tape recorder about what had happened. So he'd come from the mental institution. And this is John March, PI. He's played by John Terry. Now, John Terry was in Full Metal Jacket, and he also played Jack's dad in Lost. If you remember that television show, Lost, with the island?
When I watched Lost, I was like, hey, look, it's the guy from The Resurrected.
I know, me too.
To other people, you have to say, oh, no, that's Jack's dad.
Yeah. In this movie, he's got a kick-ass mullet.
That is true. But the detective is doing the typical Lovecraft thing of saying, I'm a total wreck. I'm talking into my tape recorder. I'm going to go back and tell you why. Here's what happened.
So as I said, it's set in Providence, just as the case of Charles Dexter Ward was. It begins at the March agency, his office, and he is visited by this woman, Claire Ward. She's played by Jane Sibbett, who was on Herman's Head. That's where I knew her from.
Yeah.
Because I remember seeing this movie going, hey, it's that lady from Herman's Head. She was also Ross's ex-wife on Friends.
When she was on Herman's Head, she was in that with Charlie Brewster from Fright Night.
Boom.
William Ragsdale, is that his name?
That's right, yeah.
So there was a little, and then she's in this movie with Chris Sarandon, so there's a little Fright Night connection there. She's a good actress, but I have to admit she's responsible for some pretty flat delivery at times in this movie.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So you do know what I'm talking about.
Well, yeah, it does have a very low budget feeling, and it had a low budget and a real crazy shooting schedule. So they had to get a lot done in a very short amount of time.
Right. And the budget was about $5 million, I think, which does sound like a lot of money, but it really isn't for something of this scale.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot. It's a very ambitious film with lots of stuff going on. They shot it up in Vancouver, and like you say, it was abbreviated. Apparently, they had to get it done before bad weather set in. Pre-production wasn't even that long. The production period wasn't that long. It's funny because they do have a nice shot of Providence in there from a helicopter to say that it's in that city, and it's nice to look at Providence, but at the same time, it was bugging me because you can see the shadow of the helicopter in the shot. It's like, didn't anybody notice that?
Oh, boy. Claire explains that her husband works as a biochemist for a cosmetics corporation, but he's from a wealthy New England family. They were having some kind of fundraiser for a politician at the house, and he just left in the middle of it to go work in the carriage house. Now, currently moved out of the house and into this farmhouse that they found that he owned when he got a box with some stuff from an ancestor in it. Now, this other guy showed up, Dr. Ash, and he's helping Charles with his studies. Okay, so that's, we don't know who this Dr. Ash guy is. The reason why she's there now is that the police showed up to the farmhouse because there were some complaints from the neighbor, this guy, Mr. Fenner, about noise, and there's stinky stuff going on as well. The police found some old human remains. March goes, boy, that sounds pretty fishy. Let me go check it out.
He takes the case. Already a somewhat complicated setup. So I had to go, what is happening? Is she mad because he moved out? Or no, it's because he got these delivery of human remains. So she's really worried about what he might be doing.
Yeah.
What did you think of the whole detective angle as a way into this?
Oh, I thought
story.
It was great. What was wrong? You didn't like it?
No, I do like it. I think it's as a faithful adaptation. Well, there is an investigator in the book itself, right? Except it's a physician instead of
it's Willett.
Detective. It's Willett. And so they went with this kind of film noir angle on it. But I just struggled a little bit watching it this time as I was trying to think, like, who's the main character here? Is it the detective?
Yeah.
Because most of the story isn't really personally relevant to him in any way.
Right.
And if you watch, like, great noir detective movies, that's always really personally relevant to them. Either their partner got killed or they're falling in love, which there's sort of an angle like that in here. But
yeah.
I kind of thought, couldn't you do the same story and maybe it's just it's actually the wife's point of view and she does the investigating and tries to find out what the heck is going on with her husband?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just felt like maybe there was a way to make it more. It was hard to know who these people are.
Piper, it sounds like you're working on your next script right now.
No, I'm not. No. Well, what did you think? Well, okay. I will say this. What did you think of Dr. Ash? Do you remember on your first viewing what you thought of Dr. Ash when they show him?
They show him very quickly, but it was obviously a guy in a getup.
There's a beard and a hat and dark glasses. Everything about it screams
disguise. Yeah.
And then it's not like they kind of picked somebody with a pretty recognizable profile.
Right.
Like, it's clearly Chris Sarandon.
I know. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember because I was familiar with the story before
Right.
So I don't know if I knew it because I knew the story or
sure.
or what. But.
Or if it was just too obvious. But again, if you took out the resemblance angle and this was just his ancestor, you could credibly just have a guy named Dr. Ash who just showed up. You know what I mean? Who
yeah, is... or it could be one of the other wizards.
Oh, right, sure. But I'm just saying if you ditch the resemblance angle, then you don't have to do this ridiculous disguise thing.
Sure. And I think you should do it in your adaptation of this.
So if you said it modern day today, you would have a lot more identity theft tools to play with, right? Because Charles is just missing, but they're still getting emails from him, and he's like, I mean, he has all his information, so he can act as him.
Yeah.
But he's missing, maybe. I don't know. I'm working it out.
Yeah, you're working it out. It'll be good when you're finished. So Marsh also has two people that work for him, his secretary Holly and this other guy called Lonnie. Lonnie's played by Robert Romanus, who was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. He was the guy that got Jennifer Jason Leigh pregnant, and she had to get the abortion.
Damone, yeah, Damone. I love the team with the investigators. I actually like them quite a bit. As characters, they're really great. And I think that John March is a cool... I like the guy. I like Jack's dad as well. I think he's a good actor.
Yeah.
But I love that little scene when Damone comes to the office and he says, yeah, quit smoking. And the secretary is so happy for him.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny little bit of throwaway dialogue, but it tells you that they like each other.
Yeah.
You know? I really like the little building they did.
Well, there's also part later on when he sleeps in the office and Holly comes in and she's like, oh, man. And she just starts kind of helping him get himself together.
It's great.
Those really feels like there's a relationship there and they're like kind of a family. And, you know, they're close. Yeah, but it does it in a way that's not obvious and it doesn't have exposition. You just see it in the way they interact with each other.
Totally.
Well done. Marge gets Lonnie to poke around into what the police found out there. And he goes out to Pawtuxet Valley, where the farmhouse is. And he stops at a gas station and finds out that the locals don't like the place. It stinks of death.
Great town person beat. And I that gas station attendant, he spits on the ground when Marge mentions that he's going to the Ward place. Actually, I like that whole scene quite a bit.
There's also a dog that got hit by a truck and then its body got wrapped around the axle. So there's blood everywhere. Again, just kind of setting a mood. Now, when March knocks on the door, a Chinese guy with a messed up eye answers. Finally, Charles comes to the door, but he won't give March anything. Now, March is pretending to be a fire marshal, but Charles is like, you got no warrant. You're not getting in.
Failed his persuasion role, right? This is a Call of Cthulhu movie, really, you know.
It is.
It really plays like an adventure of that game, because the first half is all information acquisition and research.
Yep.
And then the second half is going underground to find some monsters, you know. It's like, it really feels like how those things play out typically.
I think that's probably why I loved the movie as much as I did. And do.
Sure.
So Lonnie tells him Ward has been involved in this getting of human remains, and that there's been bodies reported missing in Europe, and that they're the bodies of wizards and occultists. Okay, that's pretty strange.
Right, because Ward was getting deliveries of those bodies, and he pretended it was a mistake, so he didn't get in any trouble. But that ruse wasn't very good, because he kept the bodies. In fact, he signed for them. And apparently they're the bodies of these wizards from Europe and occultists, which is all pretty crazy. And there are a couple of great lines in that conversation when Lonnie is giving this information to March, and March says, what's the street value of wizard bones? So that was a great line. And at the end, he says, anything else? And Lonnie says, what the hell else you want for one afternoon? Jesus. I love that line. He's just super likable, much more than he was as Damone when he was getting teenagers pregnant. And then it cuts. It's great because that scene's really well written and well acted. And then it cuts right into that awful restaurant scene where it's March and Mrs. Ward. And I can't remember what her line is at the beginning, but then they both robotically drink wine. It's laughably awkward.
Yeah, I do. Catch that where they both like drink wine at the same time. And it's very bizarre.
It's really blocked and seems unnatural and awkward. And yeah,
you're right. So we have another scene, the scene with Claire, and this is basically more exposition. And she tells him about the farmhouse and how they found a portrait of Joseph Kerwin there. And Joseph Kerwin looks exactly like Charles Dexter Ward.
And it's yet another flashback, which I think work fine in books, but I honestly hate flashbacks in movies. I think it really kills momentum.
Hmm.
When the story suddenly goes back and it's just informational or expositional. And that could just be me. I think it exposes a problem, like watching that scene there. There's this moment when Charles finds the painting of his ancestor behind the wallpaper, and he goes, whoa. He sounds like Bill and Ted or something. And I'm like, what is this guy's personality? You know, it's a real problem here, because we never actually get to know Charles Dexter Ward in this movie at all. The only time we really learn anything about him is in these flashbacks.
Yeah.
Where you don't even hear his dialogue. There's voiceover. Should I feel bad for him that this happened? Is it really his fault? Is he really in love with his wife? But he's got a certain mania. Like, there are all these things about his character that are never really revealed.
I feel like it comes across that he's a nice guy. He's just driven by his thirst for knowledge.
See, I think if you went with my angle where the investigator is actually the wife, you'd be in their marriage and you'd see what he's actually like day to day. And it would make him being replaced or being his identity stolen much more impactful, I think. But that's just me.
You're working on that script, so...
I'm saying you basically are changing the source material, right? And I understand that that's some people want a faithful adaptation. I like that too. So, you know, take it all with a grain of salt. These are just things I was thinking about during this viewing.
The faithful adaptation has been done.
Yeah.
So now take that idea and make it into a solid movie.
I just want to throw rocks. I don't want to.
But I mean, but you're doing the work right now. That's what I don't understand. Why not put it to good use?
I don't know.
That night, Fenner, the neighbor at the farmhouse, calls March. And when March gets there, he finds that the cops are crawling all over the place. Fenner was killed, and they think maybe by some wild animals. But wild animals in his house? And, like, it is a bloodbath, and there's barely anything left of his carcass.
We believe the animals were working with a locksmith. It's a really gruesome scene.
Yeah.
March actually has to step out of the room because the devoured remains, they're practically skeletal.
Yeah.
There's really not much left.
One thing that this doesn't fall short on is the special effects and the monsters
not
and stuff
at all.
Are super great. So March finds out that the farmhouse has been getting deliveries of meat once per week, more meat than a restaurant would get for a whole month. And Lonnie finds out that the Chinese guy is this guy, Raymond Chang, from Hong Kong, who's a career criminal. And the bank recently had a problem with Charles's checks, and they seemed like they had been forged. But he said that was due to a health problem that he was having because they went out and talked to him, and he was like, I'm sick. So Lonnie finds out from another neighbor that there are these tunnels on the property, a few of which have caved in.
All this stuff would be familiar to somebody who's read this book.
So Claire gets a call from Charles saying he's scared and he warns her away from Dr. Ash.
Right, he's left her a voicemail that she plays for March.
Now, as Claire and March visit Charles at the farmhouse and he's acting all strange and his voice is all kind of raspy and weird. And he says, I've grown a physical from the accursed river air. One of my favorite lines in the movie.
I think we used that back in when we covered Charles Dexter Ward. I sampled that from this.
Oh, right. You did. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So he says he needs more time to finish his studies, which are about nothing less than the interrogation of matter.
Sarandon really kicks ass as Kerwin.
He does. You know,
now, this character is much more developed, and that's one of my favorite scenes. He really chews up the scenery with this one. It's a great performance.
Yeah.
Whereas he's really flat as Charles Dexter Ward. I don't think they gave him much to work with there.
Oh, so Claire says, okay, I think it's time we call the cops and have Charles committed.
If that was the... I don't know, man. I do like that angle because there's some body snatchers kind of horror involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
This is my husband, but I know it's not him. Why have that in there if you're not going to play that moment a little more? I don't know. I think it's its own thing, but let's keep going.
So there's a showdown with the police at the farmhouse. Chang fully slashes this cop, but he gets arrested, and Charles takes Claire as a hostage and puts a scalpel to her throat. When he attempts to escape, he slashes March's hand, but he's knocked out by Lonnie, and then he's also arrested and put in a straitjacket right away and taken off.
Right away, yeah. They have a straitjacket at the ambulance, which is really funny to me. I guess they go out with that gear. But that's basically the midpoint of the movie. We did it. We got Charles committed. Now he can get some help, and all is resolved, right?
Yes. So Charles is in the asylum, and all he wants to eat is raw meat and blood. And they do a bunch of tests on him, and his biochemistry is off, but they don't know what's wrong with him.
So those are other... like, if you're brought back, you become a cannibal?
Part of the rules of it, yeah, that you're undead. Like, you're not really alive anymore. You're brought back, so you're this undead thing, and you've got this hunger. So to maintain your undead life, you've got to eat. Instead of it just being blood, it's got to be flesh, or flesh and blood, he says, so...
Sure. I guess I can roll with that. You also get super strength as a result of this, which I guess I can roll because that is somewhat related to this chemical, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought you could drop that as well. He's going to do some bad sorcerer stuff, and you need to stop him from doing it because he's more hungry for knowledge than food. But I guess they went with the food angle.
So March ends up getting some kind of brainstorm, and he goes and finds that chest. And there's like a little hidden compartment in there, and he finds Ezra Ward's old journal. And we get the backstory on Kerwin.
You say he had a brainstorm. We don't really know what happened. He just showed up at Claire's house and says, I couldn't sleep. And then he immediately opens the chest and cuts into the lining. So how did he know to look for it? I mean, I think I did see in one of the extras, they said the first cut of this movie was almost 3 hours.
Whoa.
So it's likely that this was explained in some scene and they just dropped it because it was slowing things up.
Mm-hmm.
But it undercut the one moment where we could find out if March is actually a good detective or not. Because he really doesn't do much detecting in this movie at all. They find out information, but it's not like, you know, when in Chinatown he puts the stopwatches under the tires to find out when the car leaves.
All right, yeah.
When the car, like, there's detective methods I think are really cool when you have a detective main character. And this was one time he could have used a detective method, but we still don't know why he knew that journal would be in there. But once he gets it, we have this big flashback with Kerwin in the 1700s. When they do this, I think O'Bannon really likes his Law and Order team working out the details of something. He loves those shots because those are really artfully choreographed when all in the office, you know, talking through things. But then the whole flashback sequence, it's one of my favorite parts of the movie, and it's also one of the worst for a lot of reasons, you know, because the acting is awful. These people are really bad, and when you have period dialogue like that and you have bad acting, it really doesn't land. And I don't know what it is about the shooting of it, but it kind of feels like a student film too in this section. And when I say that, I don't mean film students, I mean students who had to make a film for like their history class or something like, that, you know. It's just something that seems really out of place about it. But then they find the monster in the river and fish it out, and it's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool and gross.
That creature that they pull up and they've got on the ground there, and then there's that nice overhead shot where it pulls back from its moving eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then the scene where they burn it alive is really disturbing.
Yeah.
I was thinking, why did they burn it alive? I mean, they could have killed it and then burned it.
Maybe they could.
I guess they just thought it was so an infernal thing, so they were going to extra punish it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe. So Claire says she wants to go to the house and see what Charles was working on, and maybe it could provide some clues to his condition. And March and Lonnie is there. You can't go there on your own. Lonnie also brings along some plastic explosives. They figure if they find messed up stuff down there, that they've got to get rid of it. But before they go down there, there's a number of attacks and a murder in the area around the farmhouse. Now, this isn't Charles Dexter Ward because he's in the asylum. So who is it?
I guess it's his bad experiments as his monsters busting out. Since he's not there to
control them,
and they're eating up on people like crazy because they're just hungry and they're not getting those deliveries of meat.
Right.
So that's what I would guess it is, but it's kind of cool that that's happening in the background and we don't really explore it. I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah, I do too.
And why did Lonnie want to blow the place up? Is that why? Because he thinks there's monsters?
I think they think that there's monsters in there, yeah.
Well, it's the wife who's like, cool, she's like, we can blow the place up, but I want to see what's in there first, Claire says.
Yeah.
So fair enough. You know, of course, you want to have a look inside of something before you blow it up. So they go to the place. They look around the basement. They know from all the backstory that there are these subterranean caverns, as you mentioned, and a door that opens out by the river. So they think there's probably an entrance in the house. They find a secret hatch behind a bookshelf. And they descend, something I would never, ever do. That is such a scary part of the movie. It's just like a little manhole cover.
Yeah, and when they open it up, it reeks so bad, like they retch.
Yeah.
Like they open up the... I'm like, who would go in that dark hole with the smell of rancid death? Like, no way.
no way. And then you know what else was driving me crazy is they all go down the hatch, and they don't block the door open, the hatch. I mean, if that thing falls and they can't open from the inside, they might just die down there.
Yeah. Well.
You know, all the stuff was driving me nuts. I'm like, I don't think these are actually really good investigators. So if he'd have done something cool to find that journal earlier, it might have refuted what happens now, which is they only bring one flashlight.
Yeah, that's insane.
That barely works.
That was nuts. And they even make a comment. It's like, why do we only bring one of these? I'm like, why would you ever do that? That's crazy.
Yeah, Lonnie calls it out. And then he doesn't go, hey, what? You know what, guys? We're not on a timetable here.
Yeah.
Why don't we go to the store real quick, get some flashlights, you know, get some candles, light the hallway, get something to block this door open.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, call in some experts on gas lines and things like that to make sure we don't die down there, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But this is the really cool set piece of the movie, and we just want to get there. So
yeah.
They go down, they search around the narrow stone passages, they find a lantern, and eventually they find Charles's lab.
Yeah, this is a whole stone brick built oldie-timey looking medieval dungeon, basically.
Yeah, like it's awesome.
It's huge. And they even say, like, how was this thing built? You know, who got down there? And then they said probably had slaves build it.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because of the 1700s. And it's super cool. The place looks rad. It's got old parchments and skeleton of a monkey in there and all types of cool stuff. They find the reflux and they find books explaining what the process is. And you can see, you know, how they have that thing with the flesh wants to go back to the flesh. So like if I'm a reanimated guy and I eat up on a dude and you put the reagent on his body, the guy that I just ate up on, his flesh will get pulled off my body onto the dude.
Stupid. I never liked that. even back when I watched this in 1992. I'm like, that is so complicated and unnecessary.
You know what? I'll agree with you. You're right. Because it
doesn't make a lot of sense. They could have dispatched with... I mean, even if he'd thrown the reflux on Charles Dexter Ward's bones in the end and Charles Dexter Ward came back and then fought with Kuran and they murdered each other, it would have been fine. This flesh going back, the whole thing, it's like, why are you adding this now?
Yeah, well, I guess they just don't want to have him fight with it. Well, it's kind of a neat... Anyway...
it's not.
It is.
I love these catacombs. You know, there's pits around all over the place that are filled with half-formed monsters and stuff.
Yeah.
You just get glimpses of great practical effects. So, I mean, part of the thing is when they open the book and it explains that,
mm-hmm.
I'm so tripping out on the cool-looking book that he's got and the fact that there's all these monsters around and stuff. I barely got the explanation, too. So when it happens near the end of the movie, I think the first time I saw this, I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
Because I just didn't get the good exposition there.
Yeah. So they also find Charles' suitcase, which they decide to take with them. March puts the reflux in his pocket.
They also actually use a little of it, right? Don't they?
Yes, they do a little test. Kind
of weird, like, hand creatures?
Yeah, they put it on just this pile of flesh, and they put a little on there, and it turns into, like, this weird hand thing. So they know, at that point, this is real. This isn't a crazy person doing stuff. This actually works. It's so, like you said, a Call of Cthulhu role-playing game scenario.
Absolutely.
Like, to the T. They get down there to the area where all the monsters are being held, and then there's some monsters running around in there. These weird half-resurrected experiments. They're, like, all malformed and creepy and hungry for flesh. Lonnie is killed, and March and Claire shoot and get out. The lighting's awesome because when the lights go out, it's just black. The screen's black, so you get flashes of light when the guns fire. Or when they light a match, it's really
well
done.
Yeah, we've talked about that before on the show, I'm sure. The flashlight goes out, and then a big scary monster appears. They drop the lantern, so it goes totally black. And then you only catch glimpses of that monster when the shotgun goes off, like you said. All that stuff is really great.
It's great.
The best sequence in the movie. And the monster's all half-formed and weird. You know, part of it's a skeleton on one side, and it's got half a head. And there's actually a guy in that suit on stilts, Deep Roy, if you know who that is.
Yeah.
Very small dude. He played all the Oompa Loompas in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh,
remake.
Wow.
Tim Burton did. It's that guy. Yeah, he's in that suit on stilts controlling that crazy monster. What made me laugh in this viewing, though, is how Lonnie died, because he accidentally stumbles into one of those pits with the monsters at the bottom.
Yeah.
Very scary.
Yeah.
They try to pull him out, but he slips and he falls. And then we hear him hit the bottom and we hear some nasty eating sounds. But one thing I thought about this time is, like, they don't actually know if he's dead, because those things are all messed up down there. They might not even have the possibility. They might not even have the ability to eat him. So we could just be gross noises you're hearing. He could just be hurt or unconscious down there.
Yeah.
But they leave him, and then they blow the place up, ensuring that he is dead.
Well, maybe they look down, and maybe they saw, like, you know, his head getting mauled, and they just don't show it visually. They don't show Lonnie.
Because at that moment, all they have is the matchbook. And one match is already putting out an amazing amount of light for a match. Isn't making a halo around the actor.
Yeah, they really do.
Not
right.
Enough light for them to see down in that pit.
You're right.
All.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't know that he's dead. They you know, they should at least fish the body out, see if they could do something, but they just blew him up.
Yeah, they just find he's gone. Sorry, Lonnie.
He's gone. There's nothing we can do. Let's explode him.
So, yeah, they set the explosives on their way out, and they've got Charles's suitcase with them. That's the only thing they're taking with them, and, of course, the reflux that March is pocketed.
Yeah, in the house, they show it blow up. It's a miniature. I like miniature stuff, so I like that effect. Yeah.
So March decides to go to the asylum to confront Charles Dexter Ward, but, of course, we all know now it's Kuran who has taken his place.
Right. It's when March reveals that he knows everything, the whole plan. He opens the suitcase they found, and Charles' bones fall everywhere. Which seemed like a kind of clumsy way to present that to Kuran, but he does. By the way, when they opened the suitcase earlier, those bones were in there, but so was the Dr. Ash costume.
Yeah.
That's when we learned that Kuran was masquerading as Ash. But why is he keeping all that together in one place? Why is he like, this is my Charles Dexter Ward suitcase. It's got his bones. I put my disguise in there. You know, it's like he also should have put some headlines from newspapers in there that are relevant to that. I mean, it's just the clue box, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. March is getting really snooty with him. He's like, I blew up your house. Eat it, nerd. I know who you are. Kerwin's like, you know, screw this. And he rips off the straitjacket. And he's like, I'm going to eat you. And he says that. I'm gonna devour you and enjoy it. This orderly comes in. He just grabs the dude and rips his head off.
Yeah.
And then he takes a bite out of March's shoulder. He, like, freaking just bites him.
I know. I didn't know. I was like, why does he start eating March, while March is still alive? I mean, he could just break his neck and then have a nice feast. And then why does he start eating him through his shirt? You know, he's like takes a bite. It's not just his arm, it's his sleeve and everything. Does he like the taste of denim? I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, why didn't he just bite his neck or something? I don't know. Yeah. But obviously, if he bought his neck, if he bit his neck, it would kill him, and we don't want him dead.
Sure.
Because March pulls out the reflux. You know, this is where we get our line that we heard from the beginning. So right. You have the reflux.
What are you going to do with that, little man?
He throws the reflux on Charles's bones that were in the suitcase, and the bones jump to life and start sucking the flesh away from Kerwin. They get into a fight, and then they explode. So that's where that big scorch mark was that was on the floor. March makes it look like Charles
is... fight and they explode.
So March makes it look like Charles escaped, so he just throws his suitcase out of there, out the window, and leaves it open, and then he leaves like, oh yeah, I left the orderly in there with hiding his bitten shoulder.
Right.
So that...
Yeah, he sneaks out.
And at the end, he says, well, it's better for Claire to think that Charles is still alive and that he escaped to spare the knowledge about Kerwin. I'm like, what?
Yeah, after going that far with her on the mystery... By the way, she was down in the catacombs.
Yeah.
You guys lost a friend together.
Yeah.
Why would you hide the truth?
And why?
By doing that, also you're going to make her worry the rest of her life that her husband is out there somewhere and that he's totally crazy.
Yeah, he's a freaking cannibal. Would you... Chad, would you prefer, like, Heather to be dead or to be an insane cannibal running around out in the world?
Exactly. Or at least to know, oh, there was an identity swap. It wasn't her that did these awful things.
Yes.
You know, she was murdered, actually, by a single person.
Exactly.
All that would put you so much more. And she would believe it, too, because she's seen, like, the
people work. And of course she would.
So, yeah, it's really selfish. And then that's just the end of the movie. It goes to credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, this time I forgot that was the end, and I was like... Because I love the ending scene. I think it's so fun. And
yeah. And Chris Randon's great in it, too. He's awesome.
And Chris Randon's awesome. Yeah, yeah. I like, actually, in that scene when he goes... he says, John... I can call you John, right? I feel like we know each other. It's just so out of nowhere. Why does he say that? It's such like typical villain scenery chewing. But the way he delivers it makes me laugh.
It's good. It's really entertaining. It's that is our coverage of The Resurrected.
I don't really have much more to say either. Sorry if I was a little hard on it. I cannot express enough how much I love this movie.
I love it.
Partly because of some of these flaws, because it's like, sometimes it's so delicious when something is in parts really scary and then in parts really cheesy. It gives you two different like sensations.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sweet and savory or something. I'm getting it all in this one movie where there's B-movie elements that I can really make fun of. But then when it's scary and those cool set pieces like in the catacombs, that's really good stuff.
You know?
So then you get drawn in by that and then you come back out to the silly 1980s film noir plot. So, you know, it's got all those elements that I like. Yeah, I love
super
it.
Good fun, and I'm glad that we spent a little time to do this for our bonus content.
Absolutely. We've been talking about this movie for a long time on the show, I think, so it's good that we finally dedicated an episode to it, and that's all we have for this episode. Thanks to all our patrons for tuning in and making this possible. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, only on Patreon.
As strong as my hunger for knowledge may be, my hunger for food is so much stronger.